From Hook and Bullet to Policy and Science, we're here to discuss and dissect all matters of importance to Montana's rugged landscape and the people and wildlife that call it home. This is Montana Untamed. It's no secret that glaciers in Montana and the world over are disappearing, but now a new study puts a number to the losses, at least for the western United States. Of the West's 612 officially named glaciers, 52 no longer qualify as glaciers. That's according to a study released last month by Portland State University. The research published in the journal Earth System Science Data delineates a glacier as a slowly moving mass of ice with an area of at least 25 acres, and a snowfield, a stationary area of snow and ice that persists all year. The study found 52 glaciers have been demoted to snowfields. Six of those 52 demoted glaciers are in Montana. With me today to talk again about receding ice is Joshua Murdoch, natural resources reporter at the Missoulian newspaper, and Rob Cheney, managing editor of the Missoulian newspaper. First off, Josh, can you help people understand the difference between these definitions of glacier and definition of snowfield?
Right. So in your intro there, you had the basics exactly right. A glacier is a really big mass of ice that moves downhill under its own weight. So it's actually on the move, and it's generally getting rebuilt, growing in the winter with snow that's compacting into ice that will increase the mass of the glacier, and it's going to melt. And at the toe of the glacier will calve off in warmer warmer conditions in summertime. Whereas a snowfield is quite literally just a small patch of snow that lasts all year. So a lot of times that's what you'll see on northerly terrain high up in alpine environments, like across Montana in the high country, where there's just those little patches of snow that end up lasting all year. So that is what's known as a perennial snowfield, whereas a glacier actually has to be at least 25 acres in surface area, but also has to be weighty enough that it moves under its own weight downhill.
Okay. And so, as I mentioned, there's six of these demoted glaciers in Montana. Can you tell me about them and put them on a map for folks?
Yeah. So most of them are concentrated in western Montana, but some are in south central Montana. So there's the Gray Wolf Glacier in the Mission Mountains, and that's only about 11 miles east of St. Ignatius. So it's in the central or southern missions, just north of Missoula. Then there's the Fissure Glacier, which is less than 2 miles northwest of the Gray Wolf Glacier. So it is just a couple peaks north of the Gray Wolf Glacier in that same area that is east of St. Ignatius. Then there's the Boulder Glacier, which is way up at the top of Glacier National Park on the north side of Boulder Peak, almost at the Canadian border. And there's the Blackwell Glacier at the north end of the Cabinet Mountains, which is a little bit over 12 miles southwest of Libby. And then over in south central Montana, there's the Grasshopper Glacier in the Beartooth Mountains, north of Cook City, and a different Grasshopper Glacier that is in the Crazy Mountains, about 28 miles northeast of Livingston.
Just a fun fact to throw in there, this is Rob. Those Grasshopper Glaciers, maybe apocryphally, but the history behind them is that people actually found frozen grasshoppers in the ice, presumably from a locust infestation at some point. And that's why we wound up with so many grasshopper glaciers in Montana back when we used to have locust infestations.
Right, because there are actually three grasshopper glaciers. There's a second one in the Beartooths. And then there's a Wyoming has a grasshopper glacier in the Wind River Range as well.
So what does it matter that something that was, you know, defined as a glacier is now defined as a snowfield?
So that's what happened to some of them. there was a couple different ways that this study found that these glaciers no longer qualified to fit the definition of a glacier. They found that both the grasshopper glaciers they looked at, one of the two in the Beartooths and the grasshopper glacier in the Crazies, they're actually classified, according to this study, as rock glaciers. So that's really just that they're a mass of rock interspersed with ice, rather than simply being an actual icy glacier, just this big mass of ice that's on the move. It's really just rock with ice filling the voids. And then Blackwell, Boulder, and Grey Wolf glaciers, they determined are perennial snowfields. They're not moving anymore. They're just sitting there stationary, no longer moving under their own weight. And then the Fissure Glacier is too small to be considered a glacier. It's beneath that 25-acre surface area threshold. And yeah, Rob, do you have anything to add to that?
So what happens when they change that status, a lot of dominoes topple downstream, literally. If a glacier, if an ice field is no longer moving, it's no longer grinding, it's no longer changing the rock underneath it. And what that can do is, if people who have been to see a lot of different lakes in Glacier Park, you'll notice the color of the water is different. Especially at the higher elevations, you'll notice that the water is almost grayish or a sort of a gray opalescent. And as you get to lower elevations or warmer areas, it becomes more cerulean, and eventually it becomes bright blue. And that change is reflects the amount of what's known as glacial flour. It's an incredibly fine rock dust that's the byproduct of glaciers grinding away on the rock underneath them. And when the glaciers are active, you dump a lot of that stuff into the water. It kind of milks it up. It reduces its nutrient capability, and it makes it a lot harder for anything to survive in it. And as they clarify, because the glacier above is no longer producing it, it's a lot easier for bugs and things to get rolling. The flip side of that is that when you lose the glacier, you lose the temperature control. And that results in things like bugs that need a very special temperature range to survive no longer have that, because the glacier is essentially working like the refrigerator, pumping cool water into the system during the summertime. So things like the meltwater Leadenian snowfly or stonefly and the Western Glacier stonefly are now on the endangered species list, because they depend on a habitat that's right at the base of a significant glacier or snowfield that keeps the water just at that temperature. And people may not think that that's all that important, because they don't think about stoneflies that much. But in fact, stoneflies make up about one in every 10 insects in a stream food web. You take them out, and like I said, a whole lot of other dominoes start to topple. There is yet another way that things get weird on this. And that is when you pull back all of the snow, you expose things that didn't used to be accessible, in particular salt licks. And there were some researchers last year who were doing wildlife studies and discovered that bighorn sheep and mountain goats were suddenly congregating in weird abstract places on mountainsides. And it turned out that they were places that had formerly been covered by permanent snowfields or glacier toes and were mineral sources. And the animals found them as soon as the snow moved off, and now they're regularly using those to maintain their nutrition.
And they're fighting in ways that generally wasn't previously seen.
So in your reporting, Josh, you mentioned other research. Can you flesh out what you included there on, you know, other research on the topic?
Yeah, so 6 years ago, Portland State University released a different study that was just kind of focused, zooming in on Glacier National Park and the Bob Marshall Wilderness Complex that's right to the south of Glacier National Park. And what they found was that on average, all of the glaciers in that area, the wilderness complex and the park, had lost 39% of their surface area since 1966. Now, that was just the average. Some glaciers almost disappeared entirely. Some lost 85% of their surface area. And in that catalog that they performed or released 6 years ago, they found that only 26 still met that 25-acre threshold to be considered a glacier. Flashback to more than 100 years ago, when Glacier National Park was originally surveyed, it had as many as 150 glaciers that were larger than 25 acres. That latest PSU survey 6 years ago found that the park and the wilderness complex only had 26 left that still met that threshold. On the flip side, there are some other glaciers elsewhere that were a lot shorter lived in their recognition, unlike the ones in Glacier, which have been cataloged for a really long time. There was an ice field on the north side of Idaho's highest mountain, Mount Bora, which is about 33 miles southeast of Challis. That wasn't officially recognized by U.S. Geological Survey as a glacier until February of 2021. So only not quite 3 years ago was when it was recognized as the Bora Glacier. But this new study, the latest one that I wrote about last week, they found that it's actually a rock glacier. So it's not actually, doesn't actually fit the definition of a glacier. But other historic glaciers, you know, like in our Glacier National Park here, are confronted with the same problem. About 35 miles west of Denver is the St. Mary's Glacier in Colorado's Front Range. And that's a super popular tourist site. Gosh, there was a really early ski area with a rope tow right next to that glacier starting in the 30s. It's been a really, really popular place for a century or more for people in the Denver metro area to go to, especially to hike in the summer. This study found that St. Mary's Glacier is actually now too small to be classified a glacier. It has shrunk so much that it doesn't reach that 25-acre threshold anymore.
Hmm. So, Rob, you know, I mean, you've been reporting on glaciers in Northwest Montana since, I mean, before they were even formed. It feels like. Can you give us a broader understanding of, you know, the declining ice situation that we see here in the state?
Yeah, so back in the early days.
No, I haven't been that long. But there are two pretty important things to kind of get on the record for people to understand about the glaciers that we're looking at around here. The first is we tend to think of anything involving mountains as being ancient, as being, you know, beyond prehistoric, being all the way back to the beginning. And that's, it's a lot more complicated than that. The glaciers that we see in Glacier National Park, and I want to say this very carefully because I've heard people misuse these statistics a lot. They're only about 4,000 years old. The big ice age that carved a whole lot of the features that we know and love in Glacier Park ended around 13,000 years ago, and that was the end of the Pleistocene. That was when the big ice sheets that were coming down from Canada and the Arctic Circle made it all the way down to kind of midway through about as far south as Great Falls and covered a whole lot of Glacier Park. But then things warmed up a lot to the point that for like 3,000 or 4,000 years, Glacier Park was glacier free, and it didn't start rebuilding until about 4,000 years ago. So those glaciers aren't the things that actually carved the big lakes and the big valleys. They do come and go, but what is significant now is that they are coming and going way faster than any other recorded time in geologic history. And that's directly related to how much we are forcing the climate changes in temperature and snowfall and precipitation patterns. So they are changing radically. And it's not just in Glacier Park, it's all over the world. A friend of mine who was a Mount Everest Sherpa guide in Nepal, who was qualified to lead climbs up Everest as well as a whole lot of other places all over the Himalayas, gave up his guide license and is now driving a taxi in New York City because the routes to get to the mountains have receded so much that a whole lot of the trails that used to depend on crossing a glacier to get over a valley are no longer passable or no longer safe. They have just disintegrated in the literal sense of the word. They have fallen apart. So what we're looking at when we see these landscapes and these landmarks diminish, in some cases literally before your eyes, is a real warning call that, yes, the stuff that we kind of thought was permanent, that was forever, that was just always going to be there, is disappearing really fast, and we are pretty much responsible for it.
Yeah, and on that note, there was a study that was released in June this year that showed that the Himalayan glaciers are on track to lose about 80% of their volume by the end of this century. So in less than 80 years, they could be 80% gone. And in Europe, the Swiss Academy of Sciences also reported this year that glaciers in the Swiss Alps lost 10% of their volume over the past 2 years. And that was a combination of a 6% loss in 2022 and then a 4% loss this summer. And each of those 2 years were the greatest single year losses of ice mass that had been recorded in the Swiss Alps. It's happening in the Western U.S., it's happening in Glacier, but it's also happening all over the world where there's these glaciated landscapes that still have glaciers, at least so far.
Right. You know, and we've covered it in previous episodes on the topic, but I think it's a great opportunity to bring it back up. What exactly are folks doing about this receding ice?
That's a really hard question, and it's a really controversial question. There are a variety of researchers and scientists who are experimenting with ways to tinker with the climate, to tinker with weather patterns, to tinker with the what's known as the albedo, the reflectivity of snow. I wrote a couple of months ago about a project where people wanted to sprinkle a micro beads of glass, little glass beads that are about smaller than a grain of salt, and just spray them over ice fields in the Arctic in order to increase the reflectivity so that the ice wouldn't melt as fast. And their presumption was that glass is silicon, it's relatively inert, it doesn't have any toxic chemical activity, but there is still a whole lot of question about what happens when the fish eat it or the shrimp or all the rest of the food web starts absorbing this stuff. What's the cost effectiveness of it? Do you have to reapply it every week or every month or every 10 years? Who knows? What else, you know, what are the rest of the unknowns about this? One of the really scary parts of this whole climate geoengineering issue is that nobody knows who's in charge. So if some billionaire decides that they just want to try out their pet experiment, this is what's known as the Greenfinger scenario. It is a take on the old James Bond Goldfinger, you know, crazy bad guy. You know, what if Elon Musk or somebody just decided, hey, I think I'm going to try and see if I can save all the glaciers with some new climate engineering method? There isn't a government or a United Nations or a police force really in place to stop that or to regulate it or to see if it can be kept functioning. In a lot of cases, for example, there was a really interesting project that started a couple of decades ago trying to revitalize kelp off of the Pacific coast in British Columbia. And a guy who had the money and resources to do it just loaded up a ship full of iron filings and ran across the coastline and dumped it in the ocean. And the iron improved the nutrition cycle for the kelp, and he got a huge bloom of kelp come back. But are we going to sort of fertilize the ocean on a regular basis in order to make that happen? Who's going to pay for that? What happens if it turns out the kelp all of a sudden becomes sentient and decides to take over the British Columbian government? People haven't worked these details out. But we're getting really pressed for time to come up with some sort of a solution or to come up with some sort of an adaptation for what to do if we don't have the water that these glaciers and these snowfields provided for us. The Himalayas that Josh was talking about, they're referred to as the third pole, as in the North Pole, the South Pole, and the Himalayan Pole, because they contain so much contained ice and fresh water that huge portions of India and China, the two biggest countries on the planet, population-wise, radically depend on for drinking water.
It's the same thing here. Yeah, it's the same thing here in Montana. I mean, a lot of places, you know, rely on how a glacier storing water when it's cool and there's a lot of precipitation and then releasing that water when it's warmer and drier. You know, that phenomenon kind of helps to moderate stream flows and make sure that there is some relatively reliable supply of water throughout the year, especially throughout an irrigation year. And when it's not raining and it's warm, well, if there's a glacier melting high up, that's still going to provide a supply of water. And then as you have cooler conditions and natural rainfall, that's going to slow down how much the glacier melts. And in the wintertime, it's actually going to rebuild the glacier as it's snowing. But as the glaciers recede and disappear, it really impedes that dynamic. And you get a lot less predictable water supply for a lot of places, including the American West.
Right. Yeah. So kind of a huge deal, obviously. Do you guys have any final thoughts on the topic before we get off of here?
It just, it makes a really obvious landmark to point to and say, you know, if you are concerned about the fate of your environment, if you are concerned about the fate of your farms, if you're concerned about the water you drink and the food you eat, you can look at these things and see the damage that they're incurring and take it to heart that we are going to have to change, adapt, or scramble to respond to the changes that nature is going through.
Well, thanks, Rob and Josh.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Montana Untamed is a podcast from the newsrooms of Lee Enterprises Montana Newspapers. Visit any of our websites or subscribe wherever podcasts are found.